Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a weekly podcast where each month we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the paranormal and unexplained while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraidish together. Welcome to episode 3, everybody. It's about time. It's just going to be me for a while, but I do have a special guest. Andrew had to step away from the project, you know, some personal stuff to deal with. It's a lot of work to have a full-time job and do a lot of research for a podcast. It sucks, but it is what it is. Anyways, my new co-host for now is my wonderful wife, Ashley.
Wonderful.
Well, lovely.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ashley. I am Paul's wife, the ball and chain, so to speak.
Yeah, my ball and chain. Anyways, thanks for the reviews, the 3 reviews I have so far. If you review anything, and you don't say anything negative, please give 5 stars. What I'm trying to say is basically if you say, oh, I love your podcast or I love your product, and you give no negative
feedback at all. But your voice is funny.
Just please give 5 stars. I mean, I'm seeing 4 stars. But I'm seeing, I love your podcast, and
yeah,
just give me a reason why you dropped it.
So from a business owner's perspective, when you're looking at like Google reviews, Google and other platforms push establishments that have 5 stars. If there's not 5 stars, then Google automatically, or whatever other platform it is, automatically assumes that there's something wrong. So they're going to push those 5-star rated podcasts, accounts, whatever, over 4-star rated accounts. So it really just helps the reach of the podcast when you give 5 stars versus 4 stars. It's not to be an asshole or be nitpicky or anything. I mean, we truly do appreciate every review I've seen. I haven't seen Paul this happy in
how long?
Probably since before we got married.
Anyways, please make those 5 stars, unless there's actually something wrong. I hear people say, oh, I don't give completely 5 stars because nobody's perfect. I mean, I understand your logic, but still.
If you're looking at it from and I'm going to use the word algorithm again. If you're looking at it from the perspective of an algorithm, which is not a human being. An algorithm is a code. It's ones and zeros in a program that's designed to filter through and push things to who it deems to be preferred audience member. So if you're looking at it from an algorithm perspective, no, nobody's perfect. Po-buddy's nerfect, if you want. But the algorithm likes 5 stars.
Yeah.
So I only give 5 stars unless I have something to say. And yeah. I almost always have something to say.
Ain't that true.
Shit, you don't want to be a fast food restaurant right now. Oh, I'm on gosh. One.
Oh, shit. Whew. Anyways,
baby. Popeyes, get your act together.
I think we're going to... I've got a couple of stories.
I do, too.
Yay. My first story is of the Missouri State Penitentiary.
Woohoo!
I think I visited there on a school trip.
Not so much for me.
Alright, so I'm gonna tell this in a chronology order. Alright, let's get started. In 1822, Jefferson City became the capital of Missouri. A decade later, other towns were competing to take that status for themselves. In 1831, Missouri Governor John Miller suggested a prison be built in Jefferson City to ensure the city would remain the capital. In 1833, the Missouri House of Representatives passed a bill to establish and build a penitentiary in Jeff City. In 1834, construction began on the first Missouri State Prison west of the Mississippi River. In 1836, the prison opened, and in the same month, the Alamo fell in Texas.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, we've been there.
Yes, we have.
It was fun.
They tell you not to touch the walls.
Yeah.
You know what I did?
She touched the walls. The first prisoner was Wilson Idson, who came from Greene County. I wasn't sure if it meant Greene County Jail or if he's just from here.
I mean, both?
Probably both. The penitentiary housed only 15 prisoners who worked in a shop making bricks. So these prisoners basically made the bricks that built the rest of the prison.
I mean, that's pretty typical. Why pay for labor?
Yeah, you got free labor there.
They abolished slavery, so what did they do? Put everybody in prison.
To work.
For free.
In 1840, early prison laborers, accompanied by armed guards, built houses. Some of the lavish houses still stand to this day. When the prison, nicknamed The Walls by inmates, was completed, it was surrounded by a high limestone wall with 15 officer towers. That's a big, big prison.
Damn.
In 1842, the first female inmate, Amelia Eddy, arrived from St. Louis County. Early on, the penitentiary operated a lease program where businessmen could hire inmates to work for them. Several buildings in Jeff City, including the first Capitol, the governor's mansion, and several area homes were built using prison labor. In 1868, Housing Unit 4, commonly known as A Hall, was built for post-Civil War criminals. Stone was quarried on site by prisoners. Mm-hmm. A Hall remains the oldest existing building on the site.
A Hall, like A is the name of the hall? Not
A Hole. A Hall, yes.
Funny story. When I first moved to Missouri, I became friends with another Ashley, and her boyfriend used to call me Ash Hole, A Hole for short.
That's funny.
Yeah.
A Hall remains the oldest existing building on the site, and its basement, nicknamed The Hole, was a medieval-style dungeon that housed some of the worst criminals, including those on death row.
Can I swear on this podcast?
Yes.
Fuck!
Yeah, a fucking dungeon in the prison.
What?
Yeah. Imagine being one of the prisoners building that. And saying, why the fuck am I building a dungeon inside the prison that I could potentially be put in if I do something wrong?
Right. I mean, like, think about who built medieval prisons and dungeons. Yeah. Like, just going back, like, golly gee.
That's crazy. In 1885, six major shoe factories and numerous other industries, including the largest Saddle Tree factory in the world, contributed to the Jeff City economy utilizing inmate labor.
Okay, so we talked about the saddle trees. I want to touch on that briefly because there was a lot of confusion about what a saddle tree was.
And yes.
But first, you never told me about the shoe factories. As soon as you said that, I immediately had pictures of the opening scenes of Jumanji.
Oh, yeah. The shoe factory, yeah. Yeah, yes, I did have to look up to see what the fuck a saddle tree was. A saddle tree is the frame of a horse saddle.
The part that goes between the leather and the horse's backside.
Yes, and the bottom, if anybody doesn't know, is actually padded.
Yeah, because so I was like, what the fuck? This is inhumane!
So yeah, they do pad it. Of course, you put there's a special pad they put on the horseback, and then the saddle, the bottom of the saddle is padded as well, so it doesn't really hurt the horse.
Okay. See, I know nothing about horses. I've never ridden one. I've seen them.
I love riding horses. It's a lot of fun.
Why don't you ever take me horseback riding? Side note, our dog just farted. Oh my god, I want to die. Oh my god, Hershey!
Yeah, Hershey might have the Hershey squirts.
All right, and we're back. We just had to give the dog a gas pill because holy hell, talk about dungeons and torture.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
All right. In 1893, Missouri State Penitentiary was considered one of the most efficient prisons in the country, housing and feeding inmates for just 11 cents per day. That's about $3.32 today.
Again, when you don't pay your cooks, your housekeepers, your construction workers, the only people you're paying are the guards. They're probably even gardening and farming their own food to a certain extent.
Yeah.
That's not surprising.
In 1900, the Jefferson City Star Tribune declared the Missouri State Penitentiary the greatest in the world.
What?
The greatest prison.
By whose standard? The people inside or the people outside?
Yeah. Well, don't get me started with the private prison industry.
Let's not get political.
No, no. By then, an average of about 2,200 inmates lived in the prison.
Jesus.
Yeah. In 1905, Housing Unit 1, which currently serves as the main entrance into the penitentiary, was constructed. Infamous female inmates Emma Goldman and Kate O'Hare lived there. In 1909, inmates would no longer be required to wear the zebra-striped black and white suits, which was a radical change greeted with widespread enthusiasm amongst the inmates.
Well, duh. Nobody wants to look like the Hamburglar. Yeah.
Now we have, like, the orange jumpsuits.
Right.
Yeah. On February 5th, 1911, Missouri State Penitentiary inmates saved thousands of documents when the Missouri State Capitol was destroyed by a fire. So they basically played fireman.
Jesus Christ. Like, yeah. Of their own free will?
Probably not. I mean...
Okay. So they were forced to run into a burning building.
Yeah.
Like, still, like... I have no words.
In 1914, Housing Unit 3 was constructed, which served as both a housing unit, administrative segregation unit, and the capital punishment unit until 1989. 1954 riot ended in this building.
Oh, there was a riot?
Yeah.
Cool.
In 1925, one of the prison's most infamous inmates, Charles Arthur Pretty Boy Floyd, arrived, who was well known for his widespread bank robberies and his involvement in the Kansas City massacre.
Oh.
Yeah. In 1933, after Blanche Barrow of the Bonnie and Clyde gang was captured, she was sentenced to 10 years in the prison for assault with intent to kill.
Dang.
However, after being a model prisoner, she was released in 1939. Blanche was the wife of Clyde Barrow's older brother, Buck. Oh. Good old Buck.
Buck.
Buck Barrow. He became her second husband after his release from prison after a pardon. To her dismay, he joined his brother's gang. Blanche was present at the shootout, which resulted in them becoming nationally recognized fugitives.
Okay, so she served time at Missouri State Penn before Bonnie and Clyde happened.
Apparently, yes.
Oh, interesting.
So that was a pretty... I didn't know there was more than the two.
Yeah, it was a whole gang. It's just Bonnie and Clyde were the ones that made the history books.
I don't know history.
Mm-hmm. I know history, but I don't know all history.
Yeah. In 1935, according to the Department of Justice, the prison housed 5,300 inmates. In 1937, the gas chamber was constructed by inmates using stone from the prison quarry. The gas chamber itself was delivered and placed on a concrete pad, and the building was built around it.
Are you kidding me?
That's crazy. It would become the location of 40 executions.
Only 40?
Only 40.
I mean, only 40. Oh, only 40 deaths. Oh.
In 1938, a 5-story hospital unit with 240 beds was opened, allowing medical records to be maintained on each inmate.
What did they do before then?
I don't know. Charles Sonny Liston entered the prison and learned to box before going to win the National Heavyweight Championship upon his release.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. In 1954, a major riot occurred which focused national attention to the penitentiary. In 1967, Missouri State Penitentiary was called the bloodiest 47 acres in America by Time magazine.
Fascinating.
Due to all the riots.
All the riots.
All the riots.
So there was the riot, and then there were all the riots.
Yeah, all the riots. In 1989, Missouri State Penitentiary death row ended and all capital punishment inmates were moved to the new prison at Potosi.
Okay.
In 1991, the name of Missouri State Penitentiary was changed to the Jefferson City Correctional Center. And that's when I visited the prison. Well, Correctional Center after that change.
Wait, there were no inmates?
Well, there were, but they didn't, not the death row.
What? So they let school-age children...
Well, we weren't in the prison. We were on the grounds, like, in a fenced-in area to where, like, we had guards there, and we had, like, a, quote, good inmate come talk to us.
Why did they decide it would be a good idea to take children to a prison in the first place?
Just to show us. Don't fuck up or you're going to prison.
Right, was this, like, a dare thing?
No, I don't know. I forgot. It's been... I'm 38, baby. Well, this was like 25 years ago.
I know, but still, like, who... What administrator thought that's... That's like... it's a rhetorical question, clearly.
I don't know.
What administrator thought that would be a good idea?
I don't know.
Golly!
Anyways, on September 15, 2004, 1,355 inmates were moved from the Missouri State Penitentiary to the new Jefferson City Correctional Center east of town. The Missouri State Penitentiary served Missouri as the oldest prison west of the Mississippi River for over 168 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And now for the hauntings.
Woohoo!
Tales of ghostly visitors began long before the prison closed, with both prisoners and guards reporting having seen apparitions.
Right.
A-Hall.
Not to be confused with A-Hole.
A-Hall, the prison's oldest building, is said to be a hotspot for unearthly activity. Inside the massive stone building are four tiers of cells with catwalks that crisscross in width. The doors of the cells are less than 5 feet high, which forced prisoners to stoop down and take a subordinate posture when leaving their cells.
Of course.
Yeah, holy shit. Early on, inmates were not allowed to look guards in the eye, an infraction that could result in the punishment at the whipping post or solitary confinement.
Oh my god.
That's ridiculous.
Like, they're human beings, regardless of what they did, what crimes they committed. They're still human beings.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not gonna go into it, but I think that prisons need to focus more on rehabilitation and less on punishment.
Exactly.
But that's a topic for a different podcast.
That doesn't make them money.
Nope.
Within this building is a basement of dungeons referred to as the Hole.
A-holes.
Here were kept death row inmates, violent and disruptive prisoners, and those suffering from mental problems. The only light in these cells came from a small split in the door.
Yeah.
One inmate, John B. Firebug Johnson, was housed in the dungeon for 17 years between February 26, 1883 to July 1st, 1900.
What did he do?
Prior to his placement in the dungeon, he had attempted to escape several times and had started several fires.
Named Firebug.
Yeah. He was moved to the basement after setting a fire that destroyed more than $500,000 worth of property and the deaths of several inmates. That's why. Amazingly, he didn't go mad, and upon his release, guess what he did?
Started a fire?
No. He wrote a book.
Oh!
It was called Buried Alive for 18 Years in the Missouri Penitentiary.
Wow. I mean, that's essentially what they... Was it solitary?
Yeah, it was... Like I said, it only had the slit.
Right.
I mean, I would have gone...
He wasn't ever allowed to come out at all?
Nope.
Wow.
Solitary confinement. In this building, paranormal reports have included the feeling of having been touched by ghostly hands, an overwhelmingly smell of body odor, an apparition of a man spied on the catwalk, and movements in the darkness.
Okay.
Equipment often malfunctions here. Disembodied voices have been captured on recorders, and some have felt an invisible force breathing down their necks.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. Cell 48 once housed a prisoner who was known to be a snitch. He was bludgeoned to death with a sledgehammer during the prison riot of 1854.
You know what they say about snitches. Apparently they don't even deserve stitches.
I guess not. Here people have reported having strange heavy feelings, and an unearthly human figure has been caught on camera.
Huh.
Near the control room and in some of the housing units is said to lurk an entity known as Fast Jack. Usually spied wearing a white lab coat and carrying a clipboard, he is thought to have been a trustee who worked in the medical facilities. Fast Jack, yeah.
Is he fast?
Well, we'll find out. At one point, a tour guide passed through the control center to secure the outer doors, only to return just a few minutes later to find all the lockers had been opened.
Ha! He is pretty fast!
Yeah. This antic was attributed to Fast Jack. Others report him as having been seen in hallways moving through walls or appearing for short moments before vanishing. In the female wing, a female ghostly figure is often seen dressed in vintage clothing. Others have seen a man in an outdated prison uniform leaning against a fence.
Okay.
Strangely, some have seen or heard the ghosts of children.
Huh.
And others, even a dog.
Maybe it was all those children they used to take on school trips.
Probably. God. Maybe I'm a ghost. I'm still there.
I mean, if you think about it, you leave an imprint of your energy everywhere you go.
This is true. Throughout the old facilities, people have heard cell doors slamming, ghostly footsteps, loud banging, shadowy figures, and the smell of cigarette smoke. objects being mysteriously moved around, and fast-moving entities. They also report having felt dread, a sense of sorrow, yeah, and feeling of being watched.
Well, I mean, A, you could attribute the sense of dread to, I'm in a scary place, this is dreadful. Also, what feelings would the inmates have been feeling?
Yeah.
Dread, sorrow. Yeah. You know, especially if they were non-violent criminals, or, you know, even if they were regretful, yeah, for what they'd done, they weren't treated like human beings.
Imagine being one of those prisoners and not doing the crime that you're accused of committing, and having been there for like 10, right, 20 years. That's ridiculous.
Ugh, God.
Several major ghost hunting groups have conducted investigations at the prison over the years, recording ghostly voices and shadowy people.
Was it Ghost Adventures or Ghost Hunters or both?
I'm not sure. Here is the story of Tom Wells, who began working as one of the prison's guards in 1989. He says, they just pretty much worked a lot of all the... Fuck. He says, they just pretty much worked a lot of the inmates like slaves. It was pretty brutal. Wells now leads some of the prison's ghost tours, and although he considers himself more of a tour guide, his own paranormal experience as a guard has made him a firm believer of what remains inside the prison's now vacant cells. Quote, I'm the guy that lucked into the coolest part-time job in the whole wide world, Wells said, because I'm not a ghost hunter. I just happened to be an officer that, when I worked in there, I had an experience one day. On a sunny day around 3 p.m., Wells had been talking to an inmate named John when he noticed another inmate with long blonde hair and a white t-shirt walk out a door during count. They know they're not supposed to be outside, and I thought to myself, you son of a bitch, I'm going to jump down this guy's throat. and I go out there, and there's nobody there. I thought, man, he's run around the whole building. So I went up the right side of the building, nobody was there, and the big gate is there, and it's all locked. And I was like, I know I've seen this guy. So I ran to the left side, and there's a tower right there. I said, hey, has anybody ran by here? And he said, no, it's count time. It's locked down. So I'm like, okay. And there's a van sitting there. We used to take supplies up the hill. And I thought, oh my God, he's in the van. We got an escape attempt. It's on a hill. So I'm looking underneath as I walk up and I look in the back windows. The seats are all taken out and I look in there and there's nothing there. So I open it up. And in the meantime, John, the inmate, had stepped out front and was watching me. I shut the doors and I'm like, what? He goes, you ain't gonna find this guy. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I saw him. I said, what did he look like? He said, he had long blonde hair and a white t-shirt. And I'm like, yeah. He says, Wells, we ain't got nobody in this building that looks like that. And I was just like, whoa, you're right. It felt like somebody had just punched me in the chest. After the prison was decommissioned in 2004, Wells was asked to assist with some of the prison's ghost tours and has since begun leading the tours with his wife, who he met during his first tour of the prison, and his stepdaughter. MSP's ghost tours allow its tourists to delve a bit deeper into the personal lives of its inmates, many of whom may have been affected by the prison's more deadly and violent history, such as the 1954 riot where 4 inmates were killed and its more than 100-year history of prisoner executions. During tours, which can last 2 to 8 hours beginning at sunset, visitors are welcome to bring their own ghost activity devices or use some of the equipment provided by the prison. Visitors are then given insight into the prison's paranormal and unusual activities as they are guided around the upper yard into housing unit 1, dungeon cells, where prisoners were kept in complete darkness, and through the basement of death row chambers in housing unit 3 until ending the tour inside the prison's gas chamber. Investigation time at each destination varies depending on how many hours are reserved for your tour. Would you take a tour through this haunted prison? Could you handle an overnight stay? Would going there make you afraidish?
Probably.
Yeah. Would be fun to go to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I would be able to survive an all-night tour, mostly because you know me, and I get really angry when I'm tired. Yeah.
I would love to do basically the tour that goes through everything.
So you would want to do the 8-hour tour?
That would be fun, yeah.
You wouldn't stay awake. You'd be passed out in a cell somewhere. I saw a ghost in the corner. Oh, no, that's just Paul. He fell asleep standing up.
Yeah. I could probably do the 4-hour tour.
Maybe. Depends on how much sleep I get the day before.
Yeah. All right. Ready for my second story?
Yeah, man.
All right, it's the Pythian Castle.
Oh, yeah.
I want to visit there.
Yeah. We've actually got a listener story about Pythian, so...
Awesome.
Yeah.
Can't wait. All right, let's get into it. In 1913, the Knights of Pythias, a fraternal organization and secret society founded in Washington, D.C. on February 19, 1864. The Knights of Pythias is the first fraternal organization to receive a charter under an act of the United States Congress. It originally constructed the castle and detached power plant as a retirement home and orphanage for needy members of the order and their widows and children. It was called the Pythian Home of Missouri, a.k.a. Pythian Castle. Springfield was one of seven cities competing for the construction of the Pythian home and sold 53 acres of land to the Knights for guess how much?
I don't even want to know, bro. I'm going to be so mad.
$1.
Oh, fuck.
They sold 53 acres of land for $1 in 1909.
I thought you were going to tell me it was like $10,000.
No. I mean, because they were one of seven cities competing for the construction of the castle.
Right.
So that's insane to me.
Right.
I mean, it is, I guess, like a charity thing that they did.
I feel like this was an episode of Parks and Recreation.
Yeah. Anyways, the main building was designed to give the structure the appearance of a castle which reflected the theme of the Knights of Pythias. Its foundation and exterior is constructed of Carthage stone, an especially hard variety of limestone commonly quarried in the Ozarks.
Yeah.
It's cool. The interior construction is composed of steel framework with poured concrete floors, ceilings, and stairways. The interior walls consist of layered hollow core pyrobar blocks, which are a gypsum-based fireproofing material developed in the early 1900s, with a wire mesh covering that was coated with several layers of plaster.
Yep.
The original main floor features a grand foyer, meeting room, ballroom, dining hall, and sitting parlors. The second floor, which is accessed by a dual staircase on either wall, was designed with dormitory-style rooms for children and bedrooms for adults. Huh? The second floor also features a theater with original ticket booth, seats, upper projection, and lighting room, as well as changing rooms backstage. The building also features a full basement. That would be fun to go ghost hunting in.
Yeah.
I know how I say that I don't like basements, but in reality, I think I would go ghost hunting in one that would potentially be haunted.
I don't know. Yeah. You know what a scaredy cat I am.
Yeah. Anyways, the powerhouse was located directly behind the main building and housed the boiler as well as the institution's laundry facilities. In 1942, during World War II, the United States military commandeered the facility for use in conjunction with the adjacent O'Reilly General Hospital in entertaining and rehabilitating injured U.S. troops. Fun fact, I deliver mail to the O'Reilly Hospitality main office that I think owns a bunch of hotels and hospitality places like that.
Interesting. Are they the same O'Reillys that own O'Reilly Auto Parts?
I think so, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's O'Reilly is a big name. They own like hospitals and hospitality hotels. And
most of Springfield.
Most of Springfield. Pretty much. Anyway, it was renamed the Enlisted Men's Service Club. It's also rumored that German prisoners of war were kept in basement cells.
Oh.
I'm sure a bunch of them probably died down there, too. But I don't know.
You think? By World War II, were we that bad?
Well, this is... I don't know. Also, fun fact, O'Reilly General Hospital was an army hospital created by the U.S. government in February 1941. It was built in Springfield, Missouri to provide long-term medical care for returning soldiers of World War II. It became known as the Hospital with a Soul.
Huh.
The facility featured a movie theater, ballroom, bowling alley, pool hall, library, and arts and crafts area.
At the hospital?
At the hospital,
yeah. Why do you need a ballroom at a hospital?
I don't know. Some of the most famous movie stars, comedians, and entertainers of the era performed in the theater, while the ballroom was host to big bands playing for the dancing pleasure of the troops. After the war, the building was retained by the military for use as a reserve center until it was sold as surplus in 1993. It is now privately owned by Tamara Finocchiaro. Renovations have been completed to the property, including a new driveway and parking lot. In 2010, the castle was reopened to the public for tours and events. It is available for special event rentals, including weddings, proms, and corporate parties, and offers public events such as history tours, murder mystery dinners, ghost tours, and holiday events. Now, I could definitely go for a murder mystery dinner.
Yeah, me too. That sounds like so much fun.
Yeah. And now for the hauntings. Visitors claim to see ghosts or feel a dark, quote, aura within the castle. The Paranormal Task Force cites the castle's, quote, eloquent charm, mystic atmosphere, mysterious past, lovely hosts, and an abundance of occurring unexplainable events. As reasons, this should be added to everyone's list of places to visit to hear voices, see objects moving on their own, and see figures.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do they do overnight stays?
Yes. Cool. I think you could do an overnight tour.
Oh, like, I was thinking more like a bed and breakfast type situation.
No, I think it's just basically overnight tours.
Oh.
Yeah. The Southwest Ghost Finders also investigated the castle, and Looney, I guess one of the people there, said they were able to capture several electronic voice phenomena.
Wow.
EVP are the alleged communication by spirits through tape recorders and other electronic devices. Their results included an EVP session in which they asked in the theater, quote, did you perform here? And were answered with, I perform here. Although the questions were asked in past tense, most answers were in the present tense. Like, I'm guessing that they don't know they've passed and are, like, kind of in a loop, still right. Performing. The haunting of the castle stems back to when it served as the service club for the army complex in the 1940s. There have been many reports of unexplainable activity from those who spent time within the castle's walls during that period. Many of these reports would include hearing voices call out when no one else was around, objects such as books in the library moving on their own, being touched by the unseen, and even seeing ghostly figures of children from time to time inside and outside of the castle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm guessing, like, some of the children from when it...
back when it was built.
Yeah. For the wives and children of soldiers or something.
Yeah.
One good example of an account from that era was written by Lee Prosser and can be found on the Ghost Village website. Similar reports of unexplainable activity continued through the years the castle was used for offices and finally vacated. The castle sat empty for some time until bought by its current owner, Tamara Finocchiaro, in 2003. Once she moved in and started to bring life back to the castle, the experiences continued and have been witnessed by Tamara, family, friends, guests, and paranormal investigators.
Wow.
That's a lot of experiences.
Yeah, like consistently.
Yeah.
People are seeing stuff. That's crazy.
Yeah. The experiences over the years have included the full realm of textbook atypical haunting content. Such content has included visual sightings of full apparitions, disembodied voices, cold/hotspots, unexplainable smells, being touched and things moving on their own, and a wide array of unexplainable extreme emotional feelings by many.
Yeah, wow.
From all the pain and suffering that went on.
Yeah.
So many paranormal investigation crews have visited the castle and had so many experiences. If you want to see this amazing haunted castle, visit their website and book a tour, and even go for a dinner and a mystery murder. Would going to Pythian Castle make you afraid-ish?
Maybe. We actually do have a listener story from Pythian Castle. I took to a local Facebook group and asked members of the group if they had had any paranormal experiences specifically relating to Missouri. And one of the people in there, Kate, said that she actually had an experience at Pythian Castle, which I thought was perfect because I knew that you were working on this story. So I thought it would be the perfect time to insert this now.
That's awesome.
Okay.
I'm glad to hear from one listener that actually brought their story.
We have another listener story, too.
Okay. I mean, two.
Cool your jets, Martha. All right. So Kate says, first time we went, I carried my then one-year-old the entire time. Something kept tugging on her. Not mean, but enough to keep waking her up. The same visit, I kept feeling someone behind me, but I'd look and there would be no one. We went to the upstairs room that used to be the boys' room, and as the guide was telling us about it, someone yanked my jacket. I, understandably, freaked. I stepped outside and actually saw a figure in the window of the room next to it. On the next trip, something held my arm the entire time, like it was a cold grip. I couldn't make myself go in the tunnel. And she also says she knows she's forgetting things. She's been to Pythian Castle about 4 or 5 times now.
Sheesh.
Yeah. In the group, she was pretty active on the posts, and she said that she had a lot of experiences from Pythian. I guess those were just the ones that really stuck out to her.
That's awesome.
Really cool. Like, just having a cold grip on your arm the whole time.
And you said something about tunnels.
Yeah, I mean, Springfield built on tunnels, so most of the buildings, the old buildings, have tunnels that connect them to each other.
Now, I would love to go visit the underground...
Springfield Underground?
Springfield Underground, yeah. I did deliver mail there.
Did you?
That was my second route as a regular.
Did you smell like, did it smell like cheese?
No, I didn't go down there. They actually stopped, we'd stopped delivering packages down there. We actually, the boxes are just outside of the entrances.
Well, that's not, what's down there that they don't want mail personnel going down there?
I mean, no, it's long, the previous regular that delivered down there stopped it because he kept driving and driving, and there's like he couldn't find anybody to deliver the packages to, so he's like, fuck it, I'm gonna leave the packages at the office.
Okay.
And have them come in and get them.
Okay. So it's not like the underground's making you guys not deliver, it was by U.S. Postal Service because it was a time suck.
Yeah, it
was. Okay.
He didn't get paid for it, so it's like, you know.
Right. I'm not doing all this work.
Yeah. And there's a guardhouse that wouldn't accept the packages. And usually places like that, you know, okay, we'll keep the packages and then the customer comes in and
gets. Is this a mail podcast?
No.
I know you can talk all day about the mail.
Yeah.
Just like I can talk all day about skin, but...
Just like whenever I drive by and see a really cool mailbox, I like, hey, look, that's an awesome mailbox. So anyways, what's your next...
Oh, the other listener story?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if you had anything more.
No,
I just...
those are my two stories.
Okay. Well, I do have a story that I researched as well. Do you want me to tell my research story or the listener story first?
Yeah, do your research story and we'll end on the personal story.
Okay. So this is a house in Jasper County, Missouri, in Carthage, just north of Joplin. It's called the Kendrick House. It is the oldest building remaining in Jasper County. It was built before the Civil War, and it has seen its fair share of tragedy. Construction on the house began in 1849 by a wealthy farmer named Jacob Rankin after his cabin flooded. The house was considered a mansion because it was the first home in the area to have blown glass windows. Wow, pretty bougie.
That is cool.
Yeah. William Kendrick purchased the house and 570 acres of land from Jacob Rankin for, guess, how much?
$1,000.
No. $7,000.
$7,000.
Which would be worth approximately $236,000 in today's money. I'm sorry, but today, this just goes to show you that inflation does not align with value. Today, you would not be able to purchase 750 acres for $263,000.
No.
Like, that's millions of dollars. You can't even buy a quarter acre of land for $100,000 right now.
Well, you could, but just not without buildings, you could. Yeah, because...
Maybe.
Well, across the street, they're trying to sell 5 acres for $200,000.
That's not 570 acres for $236,000. That's what I'm saying.
I know.
I digress. William finished the construction on the house, which Rangan had sold uncompleted. He was moving out of state, and he was like, take my house, bitch, and all my land for no money.
Yeah.
During the Civil War, the area was mostly burned due to the scorched earth style of war that both sides practiced. Kendrick House was one of the only structures to survive because the Kendricks were skilled blacksmiths, which made them very valuable to both sides.
Yeah, of making the that war. Money on Confederacy. Let me make you some of this. Union. Let me make you some of this. But hey, the Confederates are doing this. Blah blah blah. I wonder if that's going on. Like telling secrets and shit.
Didn't say. But yeah, so that's the reason that the Kendrick House still stands, because it was pretty much the only building left. During the Civil War, the Kendrick House was used as a hospital for both Union and Confederate soldiers. The house was also used as a courthouse after the city had been burned during the war. Again, it was the only structure left in Jasper County after the war. I'm surprised it was only used as a courthouse.
Yeah.
The house also has a history of being used as a sick house, both before and after the Civil War. Kendrick House stayed in the family through the 1980s, when it was purchased by Victorian Carthage to be used as a living museum. At one point, one of the owners decided it would be a good idea to put a gas station on the property. At another point, there was a grocery store, maybe at the same time as the gas station. It wasn't really clear. And then at one point, there was also an ice cream parlor within the house.
My favorite food, but...
I have in parentheses Paul's dream.
Yes.
Paul would love to have an ice cream parlor in his parlor.
I would probably lose a lot of money.
And gain a lot of weight.
Yes.
And have a very short life.
Yes.
There are a lot of claims about hauntings on the property. Of course, lots of soldiers and a little girl. In 1899, 4-year-old Pauline Janey died, presumably of a spinal condition. It is said that she would regularly stare out the window and watch the other kids play. She can still be seen peeking out the windows from time to time. Often, people will walk into an upstairs room to find a corner of lacy curtains tucked back, allowing a ghostly peek of the happenings on the lawn. People often will look up from outside of the house, looking up at a window, and see a little girl's face in the window when there's no children on the property. So little Pauline definitely makes herself known. There's a Victorian Carthage board member named Kelly. She spends a lot of her free time in Kendrick House. Says she often has experiences, though not anything that frightens her. She frequently hears disembodied voices, calling from different rooms. Footsteps and furniture moving are common occurrences. Like, if you're downstairs in the dining room, you'll hear stuff scuffling upstairs. Sometimes she even brings her young daughter on visits to the house. During one such visit, they were in the house doing some cleaning when she heard a stomp followed by a sigh. She didn't mention it because she didn't want to frighten her daughter. But when they were leaving, her daughter turned to look at her and goes, I wonder who that was. On another visit, Kelly's daughter said she had seen a black man with curly hair wearing a torn and dirty white shirt with puffy sleeves. She had seen him looking out of a window of an outbuilding, a little shack that used to serve as slave quarters at a property that was in Miller, Missouri, and then the building was later moved to Kendrick House, I guess for historic effect. Yeah. So it's just interesting that a man that looked like a slave would be seen in a building that had been used as a slave quarter. Very sad.
Yeah.
The way that they treated people of color in those days.
Yep.
An antique table survives on the property. It is said that this is the same table that had been used by the Kendrick family as a dining table. Also, at one point, rumors state that the table was used as a surgical table during the war. It said that buckets were placed at the ends of the table to collect blood. An examination of the table under a UV blacklight revealed dark streaks running the length of the table, and they were concentrated heavily at the end of the table where blood would pool before draining off into the buckets.
Yep, there's your proof.
Yeah, it reminds me of when we get to Tennessee, reminds me of a story that I love to tell about a place that I'll be doing in Tennessee.
All right, yeah.
Spoilers! There's a local paranormal investigation group called Paranormal Science Lab. They claim to have caught many EVPs in Kendrick House. One such EVP sounds like the voice of a little girl. There's some debate amongst the group as to whether she's saying Carol or Carrot.
I don't know why she would say Carrot. I'm going to say she's saying Carol.
I mean, maybe she wanted to build a snowman.
Well, yeah.
But probably it could be, this is pure speculation, maybe Carol was a beloved caretaker of the child. A nanny, true. An aunt.
Or she could be saying Karen. Fucking Karen.
Yeah. There's Karens in the ghost world, too, you know.
Fucking Karen.
So when are we going on a trip to Joplin? You know, I need chalk paint, and we can go see the house. Maybe if we can catch a taste of some ghostly ice cream.
Yes. I'm going to say probably after my second shot and after you had your shots.
If I ever get mine.
You'll get your shots.
Last in the line. All right. Would you visit Kendrick House? Would it make you afraidish?
I'd visit there. Yeah.
I would in a heartbeat. Just
the history, yeah.
Yeah. I'm all about the history. You know, I don't know for facts whether there's a spirit realm or anything. Yeah. I consider myself a spiritual person, but I'm also well aware that I don't know everything, and there's so much unexplained in this world. But,
yeah, so many theories. I mean, like I said before, there's talk about it could be a different dimension. Different plane.
I definitely feel places with long histories. The air just feels different.
Well, yeah.
When we went to the Alamo.
Yeah, that was pretty heavy.
It was electric.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially walking into the actual building. It was...
The church, yeah.
Yeah, the church, yeah. It was... You, like, get tingly all over and you just feel it.
Yeah. And so, you know, some might argue, skeptics might say that that's just because you're aware of what happened there, so you're having a visceral reaction.
Well, I mean, it's energy. But,
right. Like, yeah. There's a reason. They tell you not to touch the walls, yeah. And I touched the walls, you know?
Yeah.
There's other places that I've been to that you walk in and, your whole entire body just... buzzes. And then you have people that are like, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't feel anything.
Yeah. They're just disconnected.
Well, I mean, these are the same people that seem to lack basic human empathy.
That's true, yeah.
So, like, my stepmother. Anyway, we're gonna move on to our final story. This is a listener story. This is from Lauren. Hi, Lauren!
Hello.
So, Lauren says, Hi, Paul. I'm one of Ashley's friend's clients, and she turned me on to your podcast. I'm really enjoying what you've released so far. It's been a long time since I've done any ghost hunting, in quotations, around these parts. I visited the albino farm the summer before or after senior year of high school. I can't remember which. At the time, there was less development in the area. I don't remember much other than seeing a foundation of a building and that it felt spooky being in the woods at night. There are other ghost stories in the area, tons. Drury supposedly has tunnels underneath that were used as part of the Underground Railroad. A camp counselor told us she saw kids sitting on top of one of the hills late one night, and when she approached, they vanished. This would be in front of the library in the Circle Drive. Also, we have a, quote, haunted Girl Scout camp southeast of Springfield Lake. She has been there. It was extremely scary, but not because of ghosts. Because of all the drug paraphernalia and graffiti, it felt like we would stumble across the body of an overdose victim at any time.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Especially downtown Springfield, a lot of drug activity.
Jeez. Yeah. It's not surprising. I mean, there's definite places you avoid because of suspicious activity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're trying to clean up downtown. They've made a lot.
I'm not talking about downtown.
I know. I mean, they've made a lot of changes. They're trying to make Springfield a better place.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's good. I have few complaints. Most of my complaints have nothing to do with ghosts or drug addicts.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking diverging diamonds.
Oh, my God. Yeah. They're trying to be like the Europeans, I guess.
I don't know if that's some genius thought that those would be a good idea, but, I mean, in theory, sure.
But people around here don't know how to drive,
though. Right. You get a bunch of old ladies and Cadillacs that don't realize what's happening, and that's how accidents happen.
Yeah.
It's not the flow of traffic that causes the accidents. It's the people around either not paying attention or don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, that's it for our stories in this episode. Thanks for bearing with me. I'm still learning. I'm still working on trying to get a good schedule.
You guys have no idea the ordeal that this episode has taken to record. This is night two. We are currently recording.
Oh my God.
For the second time.
Fucking terrible. I've had so many. Okay, the audio issues started when I was reading through the penitentiary. As soon as I got to the ghost stories,
yeah.
Shit started going down.
The dude was looking under the van for yeah. the escaped convict.
Yeah.
And everything went insane.
It stopped recording. I went back to where the audio stopped, and then the vocals were so low, and then I tried to fix that, and it just didn't work. And then finally, tonight, after...
literally just clicking around.
Clicking around. After, what, at least an hour or so.
Yeah, I was getting pretty irritated.
It was crazy. So finally, I fixed it. I'm going to have to fix this audio, because for some reason it's, like, super... recording super loud.
Hey, it just changed to 11:12, but it was 11:11.
11:11.
That's our number.
Anyways, so I'm not going to have a set schedule that these are coming out. Give me at least a couple of months to get my bearings straight, get more comfortable with the programs. Just bear with me until the next episode comes out.
I think we're going to be talking, can we do a spoiler? Can we do a spoiler for the next episode?
Sure.
So, next episode, don't know when it's going to be, but we're planning on doing more cryptid-type stories.
Yes.
So, if you have any experiences with creatures in the wild, do let us know.
I did forget to tell you at the beginning of the episode what I was drinking. It is called Green Ghost IPA. It's an India Pale Ale by Springfield Brew Co. It's not my favorite. I don't know why I keep trying these pale ales. I'm not a pale ale guy. If you have a taste for it, it might be good.
They're just so bitter.
They are. I keep trying them to see if I would like them, but they're just not for me. I mean, some people love them. I'm more of a lager kind of guy. If you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or if you know anyone who does, please email us at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast, and Twitter at afraid_ish. And all the links will be in the show notes. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark. Be afraid-ish of what's in it. Bye-bye.
Bye.